train roller. Freight train rolling. Freight train rolling, rolling on down the line.
Hello and welcome to Counterpunch Radio. My name is Eric Dreitzer, and you're listening to part two of my conversation with Mike Whitney. If you didn't hear part one, we got into a lot of different topics. We touched on the U.S. economic situation, the situation in Europe, and geopolitics internationally, Russia, and many other issues. So if you're coming to this episode fresh, I would urge you to go and check out part one of this conversation. And again, just as a reminder, Counterpunch subscribers to the print magazine are getting all of these and future Counterpunch Radio episodes for free as part of their subscription. If you're paying for these, then I would strongly suggest that you consider getting a subscription to the magazine. It's one of the very few sources, I think, that can be trusted for truly independent journalism, independent analysis that is not subject to the corporate mainstream propaganda matrix that we've all come to know and to loathe. So again, consider subscribing to the magazine and following along with Counterpunch Radio as it develops on the website. And anyway, all of that self-promotion aside, let's get into it. I'm here speaking with Mike Whitney. This is part two of our conversation. So, Mike, I want to get back into some of this global geopolitics and some of the really interesting and, well, tragic, if we're going to be brutally honest, developments that we've seen around the world. And let's start with one of the most important ones in recent weeks, and that is the Saudi war in Yemen, or I should, let's call it maybe better, the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen. So I know you've written about this recently. I have as well. A bunch of other contributors at Counterpunch have. So let's just start with a broad examination of that. Where do things stand right now from your perspective? How do you see things having developed to this point? And maybe generally, where do you see it going?
Well, you know, I mean, basically the Houthis were trying to remove a corrupt leader who was not, you know, who did not follow through with his power-sharing agreement that was agreed to before his election, an election in which he was the only candidate. But basically, Haiti, I believe his name is, or is that the pronunciation? I don't know. But is basically a Saudi U.S. stooge who was following, you know, orders from them. And, you know, the Saudis essentially think of Yemen as their backyard and think that they should have some sort of hegemonic control over it. So this independent group that looks as though they're going to have their own independent foreign policy, whatever that would mean, is not welcome. But the Saudis fought them on the ground. I believe it was in 2009. It did very poorly. And the Egyptians tried it sometime in the past as well, and they did very poorly. So it's one of those places like Afghanistan where, you know, these guys know the mountains and the back roads and everything else, and if they dig in, it's going to be very difficult to get rid of them. Right now, people are not anticipating a ground war, but it could develop into that. But the U.S. role is particularly hateful in this whole battle, because here it is. The Saudis are claiming that this new group that has taken over the capital is a threat to their security, which is doubtful to begin with. The UN has said nothing to discourage them from waging war against them. But they're bombing all kinds of food installations, the main food installations, water facilities. They've bombed refugee camps, schools, hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, the campaign right now is a campaign of starvation, a humanitarian crisis, and that's how they hope to win this thing, although I presume that there's going to be some sort of ground invasion. So what is U.S. involvement in this? How does the U.S. claim that, and we have to remember that the one great beneficiary of all this, because the Houthis have been the arch rivals of Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, and, you know, the reports today are that they just took over an important port, you know, food facilities, an airport, some of the main towns and cities in the area. So Al-Qaeda is doing quite well. all because we have thrown our de facto support behind them in fighting the Houthis.
Yep.
So do you want to fill in?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that you said. I would add a couple of points, too, that, look, I think that from a strategic perspective, it was quite clear that the alliance, well, first of all, let's break it down. There's an alliance that's developed in Yemen since 2011. Remember that one of the forgotten countries in the so-called Arab Spring was Yemen, right? You had an uprising in Yemen and the ouster of the former president, longtime leader, Saleh, right? And once Saleh was ousted, you had a quote-unquote so-called democratic transition of power to this guy Hadi, okay? And I wrote about it at the time that this was no democratic transition. This was the installation of a puppet government by the United States, because we should remember that the main actor in Yemen, the main emissary from the United States at the time, was Special Representative John Brennan, who is now, of course, the director of the CIA. John Brennan was essentially responsible for the installation of Hadi into power. Simultaneous with that, you had CIA and military intelligence working on the ground in Yemen, essentially, well, doing a number of different things, not the least of which, of course, training the so-called Yemeni military under Hadi, but mainly engaging in drone strikes, installing its operatives, a network of operatives throughout the country, and all of the nefarious things that the CIA and military intelligence do. This is all happening in this period when Hadi is installed in power. At the same time, because of all of that, the outgrowth of that was that Saleh, the deposed leader of the country, who then is forced into an alliance with his previous enemies, the Houthis, who he had waged war against multiple times previous to that. So what happens is you have these strange bedfellows that then develop an alliance. You have military forces that are loyal to Saleh combining with the military forces of the Houthi rebellion. And this alliance is really what has emerged to depose the puppet government of Hadi. And that is really brought us to this crisis now. And so if you look at it then from the regional perspective, the Saudis, along with their U.S. patrons, have now intervened militarily to reinstall or attempt to reinstall the government of Hadi against this alliance that has developed. And in doing that, they have to then create space for the Hadi government, which is now operating de facto out of Aden, which is really their main center of power, the coastal port city of Aden, and simultaneously create space for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is universally recognized as having been funded by the Saudis and the Saudi intelligence network. So really then the battle lines are drawn. On the one hand, the Houthi-Saleh alliance. On the other hand, the Hadi puppet government of Saudi Arabia and the United States. And that's really the war that we're seeing. And all of the propaganda about the Houthis being Iranian-backed, there's almost no evidence to back that up. I mean, there might be some kind of informal ties, but very, very little evidence to show that the Iranians are directly backing them. And that is, I think, the calculus.
Yeah, no, I've found nothing connecting the Iranians. It's just another spurious claim. But, you know, the same is true of the Sunni-Shia divide, which is another familiar, smokescreen that they throw up to make it sound like there's some sort of sectarian war going on when this is basically geopolitics.
Yep.
Where I have trouble is figuring out whether this is another U.S. proxy war to control an area that's vital for U.S. national security as far as the straits right there, or whether it's just a muscle flexing operation, or whether it's an attempt by the Saudis to expand their own regional hegemony. So I'm not clear about that point.
Well, I would say that it's probably all three. I mean, I don't see.
Is it really?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, the Bab al-Mandab Strait is one of the most important strategic choke points anywhere in the world, and political analysts, geopolitical analysts, military planners, they all understand this. It's vital for the Chinese. It's vital for basically all exports coming out of Africa. So that's part of the reason why U.S. policy, U.S. strategy has been this strategy of chaos, both in Yemen and in Somalia, which is on the other side of the Bab al-Mandab Strait. And so in many ways, I think that Yemen is being turned into an Arabian equivalent of Somalia.
But exactly. Exactly. But don't you think that this has the potential to backfire on the Saudis? I mean, for example, if you keep strengthening al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda has basically the same aspirations as bin Laden, then you're going to have the potential of these people infiltrating in Riyadh and causing some real trouble as far as, popular rioting or blowing up installations or what have you. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me like they're backing their own dark horse.
Well, I think to some extent that's true, but I think that there is a level of hubris in Saudi policy because for decades they've felt that they can control these terror networks through their, you know, many front organizations and the financial networks that fund them. That was always the forte of the former intelligence minister, Prince Bandar, right? And Bandar's now out, and you have this new Saudi ruling faction that has come in. King Salman has brought in his sons and his nephews and these the new defense minister is this 35-year-old unproven belligerent warmonger who's really kind of launched this campaign. So I think that there's a lot of transition in the Saudi ruling establishment that is in many ways creating a, let's call it, a schizophrenic policy for Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's always schizophrenic for Saudi. I mean, I've read a little bit of the Salman's personal history, and it looks like his past is checkered with all kinds of incidents of possible support for terrorist organizations. So, you know, here's the guy who's running the thing, you know, the number one beheading country in the world. But, you know, let's get this straight. Okay, so the United States is essentially supporting, the de facto supporter of al-Qaeda in Yemen. Yeah. And the supporter of al-Qaeda in Syria. But, you know, go a couple hundred miles north, and they're the enemy in Iraq. Is that correct? I mean, this is how convoluted. I mean, people who read this stuff just wouldn't believe it. It reads like a comic strip because, you know, it's just this head-spinning experience to try to wrap your mind around what the United States is doing in all these places because they're not at all concerned with the contradictions in policy. There's no straight line at all. They just make it up.
I agree, but I think that there is a common thread there, and Saudi Arabia really kind of forms that bridge between U.S. policy and support for terrorism. In Saudi Arabia, look, the Saudis have for decades attempted, I mean, let's take it back to Afghanistan in 1979 and 1980. The Saudis were some of the key elements in funneling that money and funneling those weapons to bin Laden, to those factions, the Mujahideen, which later became al-Qaeda. Saudi Arabia is equally the bridge between what the U.S. has attempted to do in Syria and in Iraq and elsewhere. You see that Saudi Arabia plays a key role in all of this. And I'll throw even another wild card into the mix here. You have a Shia population minority in Saudi Arabia, which is tremendously upset, that has been protesting. There have been uprisings there. And of course, we remember the ongoing uprising in Shia Bahrain, which has been brutally put down by the Saudis as well. And so there is a lot of conflict within this Saudi, let's call it a matrix of Saudi power, that I think is really has its manifestations in all of these places that you're talking about.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia is key, and I would think that people in Moscow and in Beijing and even in Tehran, if they were thinking constructively as far as an asymmetrical strategy for causing trouble with the United States, that it perhaps would require more of their efforts to just putting out fires, would focus on, you know, the empire's Achilles heel, which is Riyadh. You know, if you can destabilize things there to some extent, then you can cause a lot of problems because, you know, I see Saudi Arabia is basically the key for our proxy wars, the keys for all these, you know. I mean, basically, they have had a working strategy in Afghanistan, essentially a work for U.S. strategy plans there. The KLA in Serbia basically kind of worked there. They got what they wanted. You know, they isolated Kosovo and stuff like that. But now it's just they're trying it too many places, and it's just too, you know, helter-skelter. And the whole thing seems to be unraveling. It's just absolute chaos. We were talking earlier about Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you got Iraq, you're fighting shoulder to shoulder with the Iraqi army and the Iranian army, essentially the Republican Guard, and they're fighting the guys that basically you created in these Jordanian camps and outside of Ankara, and you're sending them into Syria. I mean, it's just like crazy.
Well, yeah, and I would say also that there's sort of a two-pronged effort going on in Iraq. On the one hand, there are, of course, reports that the United States is targeting these quote-unquote ISIS militants and all of the rest of that. They're fighting against them and, in some sense, standing shoulder-to-shoulder with these Iranian militias, Iranian-backed militias, and Iranian Revolutionary Guard. On the other hand, we have reports from those very same Shia militias that the United States has been bombing them as well. And so, you know, it's sort of like creating this chaos in Iraq and then just using it as a pretext to bomb everybody and to try to deplete whatever power faction might be emerging.
That's a good point. But, the final analysis is whatever potential allies you have are no longer aligned to what you're doing because, you know, if they feel like the bombs are just going to be coming my way as soon as I prove successful, then they're not going to stick with your organization. But we didn't mention that maybe, you know, the Iranian assistance in Iraq could very well have impacted the nuclear agreements as well, because the United States obviously can't put more boots on the ground there. So Iranian cooperation there might have won some concessions as far as the lifting of sanctions. Although, you know, we have no idea whether the sanctions are going to be lifted or not. You know, the Republican-led Congress is fighting a tooth and nail. And so I don't know in what capacity Obama can act unilaterally on that. But, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. And look, I think that we have to be careful about assuming that everything is unraveling for Saudi Arabia because they stepped into a real pile in Yemen, because look, what they achieved in Libya was a resounding success. They backed Al-Qaeda affiliated elements that overthrew a government that presented an obstacle to the US NATO GCC establishment, and they've essentially created a failed state in Libya that is chaotic but no longer poses any kind of a strategic or regional threat in the way that Gaddafi did with some of his plans for uniting African states and a lot of the things that he wanted to do. So using terrorism and backing it with NATO firepower worked in Libya to a large extent. Now, at the same time, there was an effort to essentially create a similar situation in Egypt, and that's part of the internal conflict happening in Egypt between the military dictatorship of Sisi on the one hand and his enemies, the Muslim Brotherhood, who are backed by Qatar on the other hand. So Saudi Arabia backs Sisi, Qatar backs the Muslim Brotherhood, and you see a territorial conflict emerging in Egypt. And so you're absolutely right that the politics and the geopolitics of the whole region are absolutely on fire. But my question is, and you know, I'd like to get your opinion on this, to what extent does the United States benefit from setting all of these small brush fires?
You know, this is just a great question. It wraps around so much. An earlier question I asked you was about this. Do you see the split in between U.S. elite policymakers like the Brzezinski crowd and, the neocons by McCain? And you just went over a huge difference between, say, the outcome in Libya and the outcome in Egypt. And this really gets to the crux of the matter. We used to do things like, you know, impose our own military general like Sisi in Egypt and create this puppet regime that basically took orders from Washington but had some sort of regional control. The new method, and I would call it the neocon / Israeli method, is just to create liquid chaos everywhere. And that basically the model of success in that sort of paradigm is Libya. You know, it's just like, yes, there's chaos, and yes, there's all this factional fighting, but at least it's like, as Kissinger used to say, one Arab killing another, which seems to be the name of the game. Yeah. So this is the outcome that they see, just kind of creating chaos, you know, with the possibility of that having access to the resources. But, we used to do things along a more traditionalist imperial model, and that is not the case anymore. And so here's my question to you, okay? If you do see this split between what I'm calling the Brzezinski crowd, the Brzezinski / Obama crowd, and the McCain neocon crowd, then what can we expect if Jeb Bush is elected? What will the outcome be as far as our emphasis in either Ukraine or the Middle East? What's it going to be as far as just basically changing the priorities as far as foreign policy?
Well, look, I mean, I think if I could plug my own website here, my website's called Stop Imperialism. And the reason I use the phrase imperialism is because I think imperial policy, imperialist agenda really encompasses both of these factions. But I do agree with you that they are definitely factions and they have slightly different interpretations of how they want to maintain and further the U.S. imperial hegemony for the 21st century. And in answering specifically that question, if Jeb Bush comes to power, we can kind of think about a resurgence of the truly overtly belligerent neocon model, the same model that bombed Iraq and invaded that country. You can see that being projected further. Now, whether that means an open confrontation with Iran, that's a distinct possibility. Remember how close we were to a full-blown war with Iran under Bush in 2007. It felt like it could happen at any moment that we could start bombing Tehran, and it didn't happen for a number of reasons that we probably can't go into right now. If Jeb Bush comes to power, does that mean that the Robert Kagans and the Dick Cheneys and all of these and the Bill Kristols and all of the rest of these degenerates?
He's already announced it. Paul Wolfowitz and Stephen Hadley, one of the two of the worst, are going to be part of his administration.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think
so. It's basically a third term of Bush. I mean, it's they're not even hiding it, really. So that means then that we could see an extension of that policy. So where Obama is under the Brzezinski model is prosecuting small scale wars simultaneously without boots on the ground vis-a-vis Libya, you might see large scale wars vis-a-vis Iraq, and that is, of course, I think what the Russians and the Chinese, they understand that perfectly well. And I think that's part of the reason, going back to our conversation in the previous episode, part of the reason why they're doing things like setting up the possibility of sending S-300 defensive weapons to Iran in anticipation of an increased belligerence in that form.
You know, it's so interesting because in some ways, they are preparing now for a Jeb Bush, presidency because, without thinking of it that way, but with the BRICS and this new investment bank and with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and all these different institutions they're creating, they're just a hair's breadth away from creating their own reserve currency. And it will come, first of all, in a basket of currencies between, yep, probably six or seven different countries, but it will quickly dwarf the impact of the U.S. currency. And if there were some destabilizing process in Saudi Arabia, then you'd really have trouble in the United States, and basically you'd have a new coalitions everywhere. So
yeah, exactly.
You'd certainly have an unraveling of the empire as we know it.
Let's
which is pretty short lived to think of it,
We got a couple more things I want to cover, but man, time is flying by. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, and I want to finish up the conversation talking about a couple of other key points here with Mike Whitney. You're listening to Counterpunch Radio. My name's Eric Dreitzer, and we'll be right back.
Standing in a queue, did you see me? You had to die.
Welcome back to Counterpunch Radio. You're listening to part two of my discussion with Mike Whitney. I mean, we're sort of hop skipping and jumping all over the globe, talking about any number of conflicts. And really, it's sort of, I mean, it's insane that we even have to say this, but they all seem to be connected. And there is something afoot around the world that people need to be paying attention to. So we talked about Iran. We talked about where all of these things fit in. And let's talk a little bit, if we could, about ISIS, because, you know, this has dominated the headlines and there are so many different opinions and ideas about it. ISIS spreading like a cancer. ISIS now, groups like Boko Haram pledging allegiance to ISIS, groups in Afghanistan supposedly pledging allegiance to ISIS. So all of this is happening. We have news in recent days of now an ISIS, that ISIS is responsible for a major bombing in the city of Erbil, which is in the Kurdish region in northern Iraq, which is supposedly guarded by Israeli allied Kurdish Peshmerga. A lot of these developments. So, Mike, let me get your take on some of this about ISIS and about what ISIS has done in Syria, in Iraq, and kind of how do you see all of that playing out and fitting into this broader puzzle?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I'm really actually kind of weak on this because, you know, I mean, I realize that a lot of these characters originally, you know, matriculated in jails in the Sunni dominated areas of Iraq, and some of them also were trained in Jordan and in Turkey, where they crossed back and forth across the border without any kind of restrictions. But you know, I'm kind of foggy on whether I think it's a franchise or whether it's a real institution. Their connection, I think, to the CIA is pretty clear, you know, but whether they really intended, whether the company, as it's called, intended to create this sort of proxy army that operates in the way they do, you know, for example, I found it very hard to believe that these, 200 Ford, or what were they, troopers, came over the border from Syria into Iraq and overtook both Fallujah and Mosul without, you know, satellite imagery picking them up and recognizing that this troop of this foreign army was coming in. So I thought there might have been some collaboration on the part of the United States, and that this was the intent was to create a de facto partitioning of Iraq, which was what something Joe Biden and Leslie Gelb supported from the very onset. He was from the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm-hmm. But now I'm really feeling mixed about it. It's like where they have overstepped their bounds. The United States is collaborating with the Iraqi army and with the Iranians to take back those cities like Tikrit. But in other places, they don't seem that interested in attacking them. Now, I know that the Saudis have only made a few weak attempts at bombing them, whereas the other, and they must be Saudi funded. We know that. And it would be very easy for the U.S. to, you know, to trace this money trail. So the question is, in what way, it's not like the CIA is actually running them. It's almost like a wind-up toy that's out there that once they're out there, they kind of operate semi-independently. But then the question is, why don't they attack Israel? So you're going to have to fill in some of the blank spots here because I am a little shaky on this whole thing.
I like to think of the metaphor of wildfires, okay? And, you know, what is the main method by which firefighters attempt to stop a wildfire? They set another fire, okay? And the part of the strategy is to basically, if they see that they have a situation in which the Assad regime in Syria has not collapsed, their regime change strategy has failed, right? And I'm talking 2011, 2012. This strategy has clearly failed, right? The so-called moderates have basically been utterly made irrelevant. The armed groups have been slaughtered, basically, by Assad's military forces, which is a whole other issue that we could probably get into. All of this is happening, and you have a program of arming so-called moderates, right? And I always refer back to a important article from the New York Times, so we're not talking some kind of conspiracy website here. The New York Times documented in 2012 the CIA using the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood to arm and to fund factions inside of Syria that were allied with a lot of international terror groups. And from this, you have the emergence of al-Nusra Front, which is a direct outgrowth and allegiance with al-Qaeda. Out of that, you also have ISIS, which comes from Iraq, from the U.S. invasion in Iraq. And you have a confluence of these groups, right? And if you're going to tell me that the CIA didn't understand and didn't know that those weapons that they were giving to the so-called moderates were going to wind up in the hands of ISIS and al-Nusra Front, I would call you terribly naive. I think that the CIA understood perfectly that that was going to happen.
No, I agree. So maybe you can fill in some of the gaps for me that, you know, some of your listeners might be wondering, too. For example, okay, it seems to me that if they take over a city of Mosul, which I think is, you know, nearly a million people, okay, with roughly 12,000 jihadis in ISIS who come up there, which seems like an astronomical accomplishment to begin with, then there must have been some collaboration between the Sunni former Sunni officers who came from Mosul, who are from, you know, the indigenous people of the Sunni Triangle, that there must have been some collaboration for them to take over a city of that size that easily. So, so that, you know, my question is, what is the intention if they are being armed and trained by various intelligence agencies around the Middle East and the United States? Then what's the game plan? Is this to create a de facto partitioning of Iraq where you basically have the Sunni section and you basically have the Shia and the Kurdish sections? Is that what's the aim here?
Well, let's it's a good question. Let's back up a little bit and remember what the political situation in Iraq was at the time that all of this was happening. You had a government led by Prime Minister Maliki, who had basically made it clear to the United States that he was not the puppet that they had wanted to install. Remember, the United States, after their war, they wanted to install Chalabi, the favorite of the neocons. That was a failure. They wanted to install Ayad Alawi, who ended up running the Iraqiya bloc. That was a failure. And instead, they ended up with Maliki. And Maliki is pretty much universally understood as being much closer to Iran than the United States wanted. And remember, Maliki was the reason that Obama had to pull the troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011.
Exactly. That's the big one. Yeah, right. He wouldn't sign the status of force agreement, and he would not allow for absolute immunity for U.S. soldiers. Yes, it's a huge one. Excuse me.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. And Maliki was not going to allow that. And there's more to it. Maliki was engaging in purges in his government of key figures who were allied with the neocon faction from Chalabi. And I'm talking about two key figures in the Iraqi Central Bank who were basically there as proxies of the United States. He got rid of them. He got rid of a number of key players, including his own vice president, who was running an assassination ring, and this was a Sunni vice president who represented the Sunni bloc. And so what happened was the United States, in my opinion, U.S. intelligence community understood they had to get rid of Maliki. And so what they did was they provided the arms and the funding to these former Ba'ath Party factions who hated Maliki, who hated his alliances, and using their alliance with ISIS, These Baathists basically invited ISIS in to Mosul and to these various parts. And remember, it was only after the infiltration by ISIS that Maliki was basically told by Secretary of State Kerry that Maliki must go, that his government must go, because they couldn't secure this, the security of Iraq. That was the specific pretext that they used to get rid of Maliki and to implement regime change by stealth.
Well, then why are they supporting the Iraqi-Iranian effort to get rid of them in a place like Tikrit, which obviously has, you know, serious symbolic as the birthplace of Saddam Hussein value to the Sunnis? So why is the United States supporting this effort to fight ISIS in Tikrit?
Because now they need, in my opinion, now they need to eliminate that threat or minimize it as much as they can, because they have a government that basically takes their diktats in Iraq to an extent. I think that that's debatable how much they really are doing that. And I think that also this comes back to what you were talking about earlier. I don't think that Obama is really 100% on board with all of these machinations. And I think that Obama, more than any... Look, Obama's a narcissist of the worst sort, and I think that Obama is looking at the end of his own presidency, and he's desperate to put out some of these fires that have emerged under his administration. And if you look at Fox News, if you're masochistic enough as I am to watch Fox News every now and then, you see the way that they're framing Obama's entire presidency as his foreign policy being a failure because of the emergence of ISIS, because of the failure in Syria and in Ukraine and all of this other stuff. So I think Obama is trying to put out a fire that his own CIA under his administration essentially started.
Well, let me ask you, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this one question. What is end game in Syria? What is, you know, now that it looks like Assad is not going to be able to be removed, and I'm presuming that's the assumption, that what, how does the United States end this? Where does, what's the end game?
Well, I think it's a bit complicated from my perspective. I think that ultimately it was supposed to be about regime change, and I think that the smarter people in the U.S. Strategic planning establishment understand that regime change is not going to happen, that Assad's not going anywhere, that the Syrian Arab Army continues to win victories, and of course we should mention with the help of Hezbollah and with the help of certain other forces as well, that essentially, then, instead of a full-blown regime change, what they would like to do is to create as much chaos as they can in Syria and to leave that fire burning on a low simmer. And now it's almost like a Frankenstein's monster that they don't have to control ISIS or al-Nusra or any of these other players, that they're now in that war and that that war is going to continue long beyond Obama's administration. I think, from my perspective, Obama would like nothing more than to forget Syria ever happened.
I would have to agree with you. I think that they're just going to leave it, the country divided, and hope for as much chaos as possible. Again, like the Kissinger thing, just one Arab killing the other. That's basically the game plan. But at what point do these, you know, predominantly Muslim extremist groups turn their weapons on Israel? I mean, I know Israel around the Golan Heights is supporting al-Nusra,
yep,
which is, I think, just 60 miles from Damascus. But all the same, I don't think whether these guys are getting the support of Israel or not are good buddies with Israel. So is that ever a threat?
Well, I think that from the Israeli perspective, I think, as with Saudi Arabia, I think that there's a tremendous amount of hubris on the part of the Israeli establishment, and I think that they think that they can control the situation and that they can, you know, seal off the border with Syria and they can protect their own interests. Now, to whatever extent that's true or not true is probably debatable. And of course, the Mossad has deep connections to all of these terror groups. The Mossad is probably, along with the CIA, of course, has the most extensive relations with any of any organization as far as terrorism goes, maybe not counting the Saudis. On the other hand, I think that there's another point. I want to bring this back to something that we talked about earlier. You mentioned pipelines. Remember also One of the key goals in Syria was to block the construction of the proposed Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline. There was a pipeline that was proposed, I believe it was in February of 2011, just before the, you know, magical outbreak of violence in Syria, where Iran was going to construct a pipeline via Iraq to Syria, which is on the Mediterranean coast, that would have provided Iranian and Iraqi energy exports to the European market. Now, the number one country that was going to
Qatari.
But I was just about to say, the number one country that would suffer from that was Qatar, because Qatar is right now the preeminent gas exporter to the European market from the region. And so you see then, as soon as that happens, all of a sudden a war develops in Syria, and the connections take you right back to Saudi Arabia and to Qatar.
Yeah, but now, since they're not going to be able to, quote-unquote, liberate Syria, then I think that may have affected the nuclear negotiations with Iran, because now they're turning to Iran because they don't think the pipeline routes are going to be corridors are going to be available through Syria. That's what I'm assuming. Is that correct, you think?
Yeah, but I think that the Iranians are allowing them to think that as much as they want, because at the same time, the Iranians are making deals with the Chinese for the Iran-Pakistan pipeline. The Iranians are also in the process of striking a huge deal with India for the development of the Chabahar port. Now, Chabahar is a very important deep water port on the Iranian coast that the Indians want to use for the purposes of bringing Iranian energy to India with bypassing Pakistan and bringing important minerals, iron ore and others, out of Afghanistan via the Chabahar port to India. So while Iran is engaging in these negotiations and theoretically is going to make deals to supply energy to the West, they're simultaneously making deals with BRICS and SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries, in order to develop that aspect of their exports. And so there's really a double game that the Iranians are playing, and I think that the United States either doesn't understand that, or I think maybe more likely doesn't have a legitimate counter move.
Do we have time for me to ask you one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
Kind of reversing,
I don't know who's interviewing who now.
Well, the key player that we haven't mentioned in all of this, and we've covered so much ground, I'm sure it's thoroughly, you know, confusing for a lot of your listeners, but Turkey, and Turkey.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Turkey, you know, you've probably followed some of the stuff at Boiling Frogs about the connection between Gulen and the CIA people that are trying to get rid of Erdogan. Erdogan is kind of a mixed blessing for Washington, because he's helping them in their campaign in Syria and in a few other places. But by the same token, he seems to be shifting towards the SCO. He actually wants to sit in on some of these Shanghai Cooperation Organization meetings. And his connection now with Russia, because of the Turkish Stream pipeline that's going to be dumping all this natural gas right at Europe's doorstep, so they can access it if they can't get if the other gas becomes unavailable, which would foil U.S. plans to shut Russia off from Europe. But they're also playing a double, triple, quadruple game with the rest of the region. I think the United States would like to get rid of Erdogan, but regime change is just like not on the docket right now, because they're just in too pivotal a position that they have to just basically work with him. But what's your take on that situation? It's critical. It's the key place. It's the node between the two continents.
Yeah, well, and actually Turkey has played that role for decades, right? I mean, at the height of the Cold War, Turkey, you know, is integrated into NATO, but always maintained close alliances or close connections, at least, with the Soviet Union. And I think that Turkey is essentially filling that role again in a de facto sort of way. But there's another element to this, and I think that there's an ideological element to it that people should keep in mind when thinking about Turkey, and that is what I would call, and what others have called, the neo-Ottoman strategy, right? And because Turkey has imperial ambitions of its own, Erdogan sees himself as basically reviving some 21st century variant of the Ottoman Empire, right? They have forsaken the kind of the secular legacy of Ataturk, the nationalist element, and instead have tried to insert themselves in various regional contexts, right? In Syria, remember that Turkey wanted to be a major mediator of the Iran issue a few years back. With regard to Israel, Turkey's had an on-again, off-again hatred and love affair with Israel. So Turkey is kind of playing a lot of these issues, and you're absolutely right that they're kind of developing this close connection with Russia via this Turkish stream. But what they want to do is they want to be able to more or less unite what they consider to be the quote-unquote Turkic peoples, right? And the Turkic peoples stretch from Turkey all the way east through the former Soviet republics, around the Caspian region and Kazakhstan and all of these countries, all the way to Western China and Xinjiang, right? The so-called Uyghur population, who are Chinese citizens, but they are Muslims, right? And they are of the Turkic language group. Now, if you consider that possibility, and then you consider the fact that Turkey has been caught internationally now, and I wrote an article about this a few months ago, Turkey has been caught funding the transit of terrorist elements from Xinjiang into terror training networks in Pakistan and elsewhere. This is the so-called ETIM, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. They're also known as the Chinese Taliban. These are extremists from Xinjiang who are funded and helped by the Turks to essentially destabilize Western China. Now, fit that into this whole equation, and you can see that Turkey is essentially trying to project their power without having to use their military, project their power all through the region, and that begins with Syria, and it ends in Xinjiang in China.
You know, I hadn't realized that, but I knew their relationship with Assad was very bad, and that they want to establish a puppet in Damascus, but that's very interesting. But no matter how you slice it, if the United States, because he's shutting down personal freedoms and freedom of speech, et cetera, and yep. very effectively in Turkey, and making it look like, well, he's just silencing people from, like as though the CIA was operating all these people or NGOs. But in fact, he's becoming the de facto ruler, autocrat of Turkey. And but no matter how you look at it, all of these Turk stream from Russia and the pipelines from Syria and from Israel off the off Gaza, all those are looks to me like they're all going to go through Turkey, the southern corridor route, to facilitate the pumping of gas and servicing of gas to Europe. So they become a key point in this whole Pipelinistan debate.
Yeah, and look, we have to come back to this pipelines issue, because a lot of these pipelines that had been proposed have fallen through. Originally, there was supposed to be this Nabucco pipeline, which really hasn't panned out. Now they want some variant of that, the Nabucco West pipeline. This is all with Azerbaijan playing a key role of supplying a lot of this energy. The Trans-Caspian pipeline has not panned out. And so instead now, the ones that are coming to fruition is the Trans-Anatolian pipeline, the so-called TANAP, which, of course, Turkey is the central player as far as geography goes in that. And now you have this Turkish stream pipeline, which is going to incorporate the Trans-Anatolian pipeline. And so the southern corridor, this system, this network of pipelines, Turkey has become the central player in all of this. And that's part of the reason why, just as you said, on the one hand, there's reasons why they want to get rid of Erdogan. On the other hand, Erdogan serves an important purpose. And I think that that's exactly what Erdogan's been counting on all along.
Yeah, it's just too complicated to get rid of him, especially with the role he's playing in Syria. And, he's like a man who knows too much. And, in some ways, the U.S. likes having an autocrat, in place. But on the other hand, he has made life rough for them, especially with his alliance with Moscow and Putin.
Yep.
So that's definitely a place to watch. But we don't really, I go to the Turkish news hurry at every day to get my news on what's going on, because they just don't seem to follow it very closely in Western media.
Yeah, and actually, if I could, not that I have any reason to do this, but I could plug another website, Trend, right? Trend is an important Azerbaijani website, and you want to follow important developments as far as pipelines go. Trend is a good source for that as well. I follow that regularly. But I think we're all out of time here, Mike. I think that we covered so many different things. And of course, I mean, obviously, I definitely want to have you back and talk to you again at some point in the near future, because all of these developments really, it feels like, and I don't know, it feels to me at least, like everything seems to be accelerating, that things are changing so fast that we really need to keep our finger on the pulse, so to speak.
Yeah, it was great. I hope it didn't sound too much like inside baseball to your listeners, but it was fun for me, because actually I had a couple questions that I wanted to run by you, and you answered them very well, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily planning on going as deep, but then again, I mean, this is what happens when you get into a good conversation. So, Mike, I want to thank you again for coming on Counterpunch Radio. I want to tell listeners, you know, Grasping at Straws, the regular column, check it out in Counterpunch, the print issue, every issue. It's always good, always, I think, critical to understanding a lot of key issues around the world. And so, Mike Whitney, thanks again for coming on Counterpunch Radio.
Thanks, Eric.